And it is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Monday afternoon. Although Arab and Muslim issues have dominated the early part of the 21st century, most Westerners know little about its prime prophet. Joining us now is journalist Leslie Hazelton. She's reported from the Middle East for some 13 years and is the author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. Leslie Hazelton joins us from Seattle's KUOW. Welcome to you, Leslie. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Joseph.
And welcome to you. Let me ask you, how important were your years spent in the Middle East to your understanding of Muhammad and to writing this book?
Oh, absolutely vital. I see this very much as a Middle East book. And I think, you know, when you try and look at someone's life separate from a real understanding of the place, the physical place, the culture that arises out of that place and so on, then you're very much at a disadvantage. And I think having lived for so long in the Middle East, having roamed pretty freely around the Middle East since then, gave me a huge advantage, just understanding the climate, understanding the culture. Also, I lived with and worked with Bedouin for a year in the Sinai Desert, which was an immense help. I've spent time alone on top of Mount Sinai, so all these things sort of give me just a feel for the landscape, a feel for the climate, a feel for the place itself. And I think that sense of place is vital to understanding someone, especially since the sense of place was all the more important in 7th century Arabia than it is now. Nowadays, we're so mobile. But then you were determined, you were defined by where you came from. You were named after where you came from.
What drew you there to begin with? Was it something that you were so very, very vitally interested in, or was it just an assignment?
To the Middle East?
Yes.
No, it was basically, you know, a 20-year-old rebellion. But but once I was there, it was it is the most astonishing feeling. These places you've only sort of that are just names, you know, Jerusalem, Galilee, Nazareth, Bethlehem, and so on, become real and achieve another kind of reality that goes much, much deeper than simply the kind of devotional sort of almost mythical image. And the same goes for, you know, for Cairo, for Petra, and of course for Mecca and Medina, to which I haven't been since I'm not Muslim, and only Muslims are allowed in there. But I have a very, very good sense of that landscape, of those mountains, of what it's like in the high desert. And I think that was a tremendous advantage in writing this book.
It seems as though you wanted to set the record straight on Muhammad and separate the man from the myth and see him whole, as I heard you say. What inspired your interest in Muhammad?
Well, my previous book, After the Prophet, was about the Shia-Sunni split, which began, in a sense, at the moment of his death. So as part of my background research for that, I read several biographies of Muhammad and was kind of frustrated. It was almost as though the more I read about him, the more I knew. That is, I seemed to know a lot about him, but I still had no real sense of the man himself. It was almost like looking through a telescope the wrong way round. So you could see everything, but it just became smaller instead of larger. And I thought, no, I really want to know. I really want a good feel for the man himself. I want to see him whole. I want to see him in detail. I want to understand what was happening here. And I think, you know, this is one reason that so many of us know so little about Muhammad. Most of what has been written about him in current times, in any case, is either devotional or extremely prejudicial. And I wanted to take a path that was neither of those. I wanted to record him the integrity of reality, to see him as he really was, without judgment, but with empathy. And you're right, I wanted to do justice to, I mean, this remarkable life. Here's a man who carved this huge profile in history, who radically changed his world and is still changing ours. How can we know so little about him? And I think the way we can know about him is to use that empathy to try and... What I did was go back to the earliest sources and, informed by that sense of what it's like in the Middle East, recreate both the man, his place, and his time. And this is really what the book is about. It's the most extraordinary combination of the man and place and time. And to take any one of those in isolation, I think, takes away from his story.
Touch on the parallels of the young lives of both Jesus and Muhammad.
Well, there are miracle stories about both, of course, even though, and the miracle stories are very, in Islam, are very treasured by traditionalists, even though the Quran itself quite clearly states that no miracles are necessary and there will be no miracles. The only miracle, basically, in Islam is the existence of the Quran itself. But still, there's a very, very human need for miracles. So you get miracle stories about Muhammad's, even from before he was born, you know, his when his mother was pregnant with him, her belly was said to shine with such a light that it could be seen all the way from Damascus, which is 700 miles from Mecca. So obviously, you know, a miracle story, and but one that's very beautiful, you know, that idea of the light shining so far and so on. But from a historian's point of view, and obviously I'm approaching this as a historian, not exactly historically accurate. So there's a fine line here between the two things come together. They interact all with each other, even in the earliest histories and biographies of Muhammad, the earliest Islamic ones, that is, from the 8th and 9th centuries, which are the ones that this book is based on. And it's a matter of differentiating between the two. For instance, Muhammad was fostered out to a Bedouin family for breastfeeding when he was an infant, right? And you get, there's a whole account by the woman, the Bedouin woman, who fostered him, who adopted him, basically, for the first 5 years of his life. And the first half of it is wonderful. I mean, I spent time with the Bedouin, and you can hear she's busy chatting away, and she said, I says to my husband, and my husband says to me, and the donkey's like this, and the camel's like this, and oi, the troubles we're having, and so on and so on. And then she actually takes the child and starts on her way back over the mountains to the high desert. And the whole tone of the account changes, and suddenly it becomes a miracle story, and you get that very, very sort of ethereal, devotional feel to it, and it doesn't feel like a Bedouin woman speaking anymore. So I've been approaching this sort of trying to weed out, where it feels real, you know, based on my experience of the Middle East, and where I can see that it's been written over later in the light of later devotion. With, you know, and the devotion, of course, comes, I think we have to understand this, from great love and great reverence for Muhammad, and which is I think, has to be treated with respect. But again, you know, I'm trying to differentiate here between devotional biography and historical biography. So it's a fine line.
Muhammad returns to Mecca after living with his Bedouin foster parents. When did he do that, and why did he leave them?
Well, that also is very interesting. He usually, children, and this is sort of upper class children, and it's important to note here that Muhammad was born into the ruling tribe of Mecca, the Quraysh, but he was born very much on the margins of that tribe by virtue of having been an orphan. That is, his father died before he was born. Not only before he was born, his father died without even knowing that he'd sired a son. So, and this also, this was another major means of defining oneself, of identity. You were where you came from, and you were the son of, or the daughter of. So to be the son of a man who did not exist, whom he'd never even laid eyes on, who'd never laid eyes on him, placed him on the margins of his own society. But still, it was, you know, he was born into the ruling tribe, and like most children of that ruling tribe, was fostered out for breastfeeding for the first 2 years, except he stayed with the Bedouin for 5 years. And the question, of course, is why? Why so long? Why was he not returned earlier? And it's striking to me, in any case, that his mother, meanwhile, had not remarried. Usually what happened was that if a woman was widowed in that way, she would be remarried very quickly, if to nobody else than to one of the brothers of the dead husband. This did not happen, and I think is another indication of how marginalized both he and his mother were within the ruling tribe. When he finally was returned to them, it was after basically, the foster parents were worried that he was ill, and they were also worried that, you know, they hadn't been getting paid. You know, there was no payment forthcoming because there was nobody to, there was no husband to pay them. So finally, they returned him to Mecca to his mother. And here, you know, is double tragedy because his mother died a year later. He only knew his mother for 1 year. So there he is, 6 years old, doubly orphaned, immensely marginalized within his own society, and seeing his own society with these outsider eyes, with these Bedouin eyes. Mecca, at the time, was like a kind of, I think you could call it a 7th century Arabian equivalent of a Wall Street bull market. It was immensely successful, a trading center, but also a pilgrimage center. What we now call the Kaaba, that shrine, was there before Islam, before Muhammad. And pilgrims came from all over Arabia to sacrifice and pray at the shrine, which was the shrine to Allah, God, the high God, in the same sense as Elohim in Hebrew and El in the Sumerian and Phoenician systems. So basically what the elite tribe of the Quraysh who ruled Mecca were doing, they were profiting off both trade and piety, because of course there were fees for everything and so on. Fees for access to the shrine, fees to sacrifice at the shrine, fees for the special clothes you had to wear at the shrine and so on. And you know, this young 5-year-old coming from this immensely egalitarian society of the Bedouin, where basically the tribe is only as strong as its weakest member. And he comes back to this Wall Street gone amok atmosphere where greed, corruption, profit is king. And he's in shock. He's in shock. You know, he's seeing these are meant to be his own people, and yet he's completely marginalized among them, and he's seen them with these stranger eyes. And I think this is essential to understanding Muhammad, is that he could see his society in a way that most people inside it could not. When you are inside, when you're accepted inside, you take the status quo for granted. It's to your advantage. You don't question anything. When you come from the outside and it's working against you, you are full of questions, and you see it as it really is, with very, very clear eyes. And I think this is essential to understanding some of what Muhammad was, and who he was.
We're going to continue with the story, starting where we left off. We're speaking with Leslie Hazelton. Her latest book is The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad, on today's Topical Currents. Please stay with us. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we do return. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, is today's Topical Currents. Our guest is journalist Leslie Hazelton. She's written The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. She's joining us from Seattle. Tell me, Leslie Hazelton, you talk about that you took Muhammad from two dimensions to three dimensions in the book. Could you explain that?
I hope more than three. yes, the... He tends to become two-dimensional in most biographies by virtue of both reverence and prejudice do this. You know, in a way, to revere someone, to adore them, is also to reduce them to two dimensions. They become absolutely perfect. And Muhammad is regarded by many Muslims as the perfect man. But, you know, perfection is inhuman. And the Quran makes it clear many times. You know, the Quran, of course, is entirely in the voice of God speaking to Muhammad, telling Muhammad to tell people, I'm just a man, I am just one of you. And therefore, basically, fallible, not quite perfect. And I think, you know, if you want to accord your subject the respect of a full life lived, as I say, the integrity of reality, you have to be able to see them whole, both, you know, the enormous achievement of what he did, and the radical impact of his message, but also the things that you may not be quite so in agreement with. And this, I think, is a matter of basic respect for the integrity of the man himself.
I wanted to go back to, he's 6 years old, he sees all the corruption and the economic injustice, and social injustice in Mecca. Mm-hmm. And then what happened? When did he marry Khadija, is it?
Khadija, yeah. That took some time. He had to work his way up. He was sort of shunted around from one household to another after his mother died. And he was put to work eventually on the camel trains, the big camel caravans that went north to Damascus and south to Yemen. And, you know, this may sound sort of quaint to people nowadays, you know, camel caravans. These were 2,000 camels at a time. They were major, major trading ventures. And they were organized in cartels. The elite all had various shares in them. He was put to work. We know that he was put to work as a mere camel boy on them. From one account we have in which he was on the caravan going north to Damascus. And it's another miracle story, but it's a very revealing one, I think. And in it, a Christian hermit, a monk, and there were many such hermits at the time, sees the caravan coming and sees a cloud hanging over a certain, you know, hovering over a certain point in the caravan, recognizes this as an omen, invites everybody in to dine, and of course they all come in, leaving behind the camel boy to look after the camels and everything. And the monk looks at them and says, there's someone not here. And they say, no, we just left the camel boy behind. He says, bring in the camel boy. And the moment he sees him, recognizes him as a future savior of his people and so on. So it's a classic miracle story, and it's one, you know, that's all the more important in that this was at the time on the road to Damascus was part of the Byzantine Christian Empire. So here you have, even as you know that his own people are going to reject him, you have the Christians accepting him and recognizing him as the prophet he is due to become. But the most interesting thing about the story is that it makes it clear how lowly his rank was, that he could, you know, the people were simply ignoring him, his own people. And eventually what he did is he worked his way up. He worked his way up to become a trader's representative, basically a business agent on the caravans. And in his 20s, one of his clients was a twice-widowed woman, 15 years older than him, called Khadija. And she proposed to him, which, of course, was very unusual at the time. Mm. Because, of course, he could not propose to her. I mean, how could, you know, someone like him propose to her? She was one of the higher rank and so on. And because she'd been twice widowed already, she was sort of refusing to be married off, as women were at the time. She was a very, very unusual woman in that she was financially independent and could see that in Muhammad there was the man who was known as the Amin, the trustworthy one, right? And it was an extraordinary marriage, at any time, but especially for that time. They would be married 24 years until her death in a loving, monogamous relationship. They had four daughters, one son who died in infancy, which was, you know, the sadness between them. But she was his rock. She was his pillar. She was. It was a relationship of real mutual respect and love. And it's clear that later in life, in the last 10 years of his life, he did marry 9 other wives. Most of them were diplomatic marriages of the kind that any leader at the time made. By then, of course, he was a leader. But it was quite clear that he mourned Khadija till the day he died. Mm.
Leslie Hazelton, you tell us that you're a Jewish agnostic. Do you feel that it gives you a very impartial view on writing about Muhammad?
I don't know if there is such a thing as an impartial view. When you're a biographer, you know, you're exercising empathy. You're trying to understand things as they happen from the point of view of your subject, to understand not just what, where, and when, which is the usual approach, but why? How did all this happen? What did it feel like, and so on? What was going on in his mind? So there's a certain chutzpah involved here, trying to put yourself in the shoes of someone like Muhammad, or in the sandals of someone like Muhammad. But yes, I think it's an advantage in that, as an agnostic, I think of it in a way as a kind of agnostic biography, and that I'm not taking a stand, and that I'm willing to say, you know, I don't know exactly how it was. I'm not laying down the law here. I'm not saying it was definitely this way or definitely that way. There's been far too much of that done already around the figure of Muhammad. I'm saying, you know, it could have been this way. Let's look at this possibility, or let's look at this possibility, or let's try and figure out what was really happening here. and suggesting, basically it's more, I think of it as more an exploration of Muhammad from a position of respect, and but respect for the integrity, for his own integrity.
We're speaking
and for my own too. Sorry.
Right. No, yeah. Excuse me. We're speaking with veteran journalist Leslie Hazelton about her latest book, "The First Muslim: The Story of Muhammad." If you want to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. If you have questions or comments, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. I'd like you to tell us about Muhammad's first, is it pronounced Quranic revelation in 610? What happened and what didn't happen?
Oh, that night on the mountain.
Yes.
He was completely, from what I can make out, and again, this is from the earliest Islamic accounts, from the wonderful early biography of him by Ibn Ishaq, and a century later, the multi-volume history of early Islam by al-Tabari. He was completely unprepared for this. He used to go out for retreats, solitary retreats, on a mountain just outside Mecca called Mount Hira. And, you know, this in itself was interesting, that he felt the need to do such retreats, that even though he'd been successful in life and had achieved this, I would say, the more happiness and more contentment than he had ever expected as a child, or ever could have hoped for even as a child after that really, really difficult childhood. With Khadija, he'd found contentment and the respect of his peers. But still, that awareness that something was wrong here, that something was missing, that his place, his city, his people, Mecca, were going in simply the wrong direction. So he would spend whole nights meditating alone, standing in meditation alone on Mount Hira. And then came that one night in the month of Ramadan, as you say, in the year 610, when revelation, the first Quranic revelation, which is not the whole of the Quran, it was just five brief verses, and he could not believe that this was happening to him. There is this God, Allah, the remote, all, you know, universal God was speaking to him. He had this immense sense of modesty. This could not be happening to him. This idea that he might be the prophet of his people was just unfathomable. And yet here was this voice saying it to him. And his first reaction seems to me so extraordinarily human. His first reaction was, this can't be real. I must be imagining this. This must be my own mind playing tricks on me. Or maybe I've been possessed by an evil jinn, a spirit, out to deceive me and so on. And in fact, he was so terrified that this might be true that his first impulse was to put an end to this whole experience by going up to the highest crag of the mountain and leaping off and putting an end to all experience by putting an end to his life, basically. This is there in the earliest biographies, and I know that, you know, many Muslims don't want to hear it because it implies that, you know, the Prophet for a moment there doubted. But it's this doubt that makes him so human to me, that sort of gave me the way in, that allowed me to see him as he really was. He fled down that mountain not shouting hallelujah and bless the Lord and I've seen the light and I've seen the truth and so on. He fled down in terror for his sanity, for his life. And he sought refuge in the arms of Khadija. And it was Khadija who held him through the rest of the night. And he was shaking, literally shaking in her arms. And she sort of wrapped her robe around him until finally he sort of, you know, went into sleep. And it was she who assured him that he was not losing his mind, that this was real, that he was indeed the prophet of his people. And you know, if it wasn't for him, for her, I'm not sure he would have survived that night.
We're speaking with journalist Leslie Hazelton about her latest book, The First Muslim, on today's Topical Currents. We need to take another break. We have some emails and some calls, and we'll get to those when we return. Please stay with us.
And we're back, 35 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and journalist Leslie Hazelton joining us from Seattle. And Her book is The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. Tell me more, Leslie Hazelton, about the blog Accidental Theologist.
I think I started it because I wanted to figure out what on earth an accidental theologist is, and I'm still trying to figure it out about 3 or 4 years after I began it, but I know I'm enjoying it tremendously. It's basically it's focused on my obsession with this vast and volatile arena in which politics and religion intersect, which is, of course, you know, thus my interest in Muhammad, my interest in the Shia-Sunni split, and my interest, in fact, in the early development of all three of the great monotheisms. Because, you know, if you look back at early Judaism and early Christianity, as well as early Islam, they all began as movements, mass movements, of protest and in the demand for social justice against the corruption of kings in the Hebrew Bible, against the corruption of occupation in the Greek Bible, against the corruption of an oligarchy, a kind of Wall Street oligarchy in the Quran. But also, I, you know, was delighted to figure out that this, to realize that this sort of spreads out into just about the whole of life. I mean, I think the subtitle is An Agnostic Eye on Religion, Politics, and Existence. And, of course, I'm trained as a psychologist. And this seems to cover a multitude of sins. Or virtues. Okay, probably sins. But the only post I've ever posted that garnered just about hardly any readers was when I indulged myself completely and wrote a post in praise of the muscles of Rafa Nadal, the tennis player, and it turned out that I was the only accidental theologist interested in tennis. But basically what I want to do is to, you know, as it goes on, I want to sort of follow up more about what I mean by that agnostic eye.
You mentioned the Shia-Sunni split. And of course, you wrote an entire book about it. In a thumbnail, give us the time frame, basic issues, and the history, and why is it still so important?
Oh, thumbnail. Ah.
Well, a basic thumbnail.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the reason I wrote that book, After the Prophet, was that it is truly an epic story, as one might expect. You know, otherwise, how could it have lasted so long? How could this still be the point of such contention 1,400 years later? Basically, though, let me try and thumbnail it. It had to do with who would be the successor to Muhammad. And the Shia point of view is that the person Muhammad wanted to succeed him after his death would be Ali, his son-in-law and his first cousin. And the Sunni point of view was that the person he wanted would be elected more by consensus, basically, by the leadership, but would be the father of the youngest of the wives he married after Khadija's death. And Ali, it should be noted, as the son-in-law, married Khadija's daughter. So the women are very important here. But basically, it was a conflict over who would be the successor to Muhammad.
Can I interrupt you here just for a second to ask you to continue with what you're saying, but why did he fail to name a successor? He had an illness that had several days. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Well, of course, everybody maintains that he did. But every time it's sort of, you know, something comes up, it's never absolutely crystal clear. It's always interpreted as, well, clearly, you know, they say he wanted Ali, or clearly he wanted Abu Bakr, but it never is absolutely crystal clear. He never said, you know, in so many words, this is the person who will lead the Muslim community on my death. And as you say, his final illness lasted 10 days. From everything I can make out, the symptoms are very close to those of bacterial meningitis, which was quite rife in the Middle East at the time. In fact, still is. But, of course, at that time, there were no antibiotics. It was blinding sensitivity to light, to noise, very, very high fever, wafting in and out of consciousness and so on, and building up. And the duration also, which was 10 days. But Everybody had their interests. Of course, by then he was the leader. He was adulated. Everything he said was being written down. Everybody later would claim to be the closest to him and the one who knew best what he, you know, like any leader of the time, or any leader of our time. Everybody said that they knew what he wanted. And there were many, many different versions of it. I think there is, you know, I cannot judge between them. I simply find it impossible to say, okay, this one was right and that one was wrong. But it is a totally epic story that has to do with friendship, with closeness, with loyalty, with a feeling of betrayal, with the desire to know where the essence of Islam lies.
Let's take a quick phone call. Our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email us radio@wlrn.org. We've got Pete in Miami. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest a question. This question would be outside the realm of Christianity, Islam, or Judaism, if I'm saying it right. But did you talked about two individuals, Muhammad and Jesus. Did they exist in a time period aside from the Bible and aside from the Torah? Is there evidence to suggest that he was part of the census at that time? Did Rome conduct the census? And I think that gives more concrete to the 20th century individual.
I got you.
Can you, as a historian, more or less take me back there and say, hey, you know, there is records that Jesus of Nazareth... existed as part of the Roman census, as well as
Muhammad. Let Leslie Hazelden answer your question then.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think there's little doubt that a Jesus actually existed, historically existed. The specific Jesus, it's very, very hard to pin down. But his story, the basic story of the preacher from Galilee who then got into trouble with the authorities in Jerusalem and was crucified, which was the standard Roman punishment at the time, is very, very real. So even though there are no absolutely contemporary accounts, you know, history is always written by is always written later. You know, we seem to expect that there will be the account of Jesus's, you know, preaching or of his execution would have been in, you know, the Jerusalem Post of that day. Well, it wasn't, because the Jerusalem Post of that day did not exist, of course. In fact, as regards Muhammad, there was a lot more pretty solid historical evidence. In fact, there's masses of it. There is no archaeological evidence because... partly because the Saudis who now control Arabia will not allow archaeological investigation, partly because the means of writing things down was so friable, the parchment would deteriorate and then had to be rewritten. But there are so many accounts and so from pretty close in to Muhammad's actual life, and also the way. The way Muslim historians worked in the 8th and 9th centuries was fascinating. They would establish the chain of connection. So, for instance, you know, even though it might be three generations later, it would go this way. It would go this way. Somebody would say, well, okay, I heard this from A, who heard this from B, who heard this from C, who was there when it happened. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else would say, well, I heard it from F, who heard it from G, who heard it from H, who was there when it happened, and so on. So you may get 12 or 20 different accounts this way, and each of them is told in a different voice and in a different way, focusing on different details, but the thrust of the stories remains the same. So you can judge pretty well, you know, what's real and what's not real. So yes, I think there is no doubt as to Muhammad's historical reality, as to the historical reality of the specific man, Jesus, that's harder to establish. But certainly a specific man, Jesus, existed, of that I have no doubt.
I'd like to get back to his time in Mecca before his exile, but we're on Topical Currents. We need to take another break. Leslie Hazelden, veteran journalist, her latest book, The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. We'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Leslie Hazelton. She's a veteran journalist and former psychologist. Her latest book, The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. I'd like to move along to Muhammad's exile from his home in Mecca and about the community he founded in Medina.
Mm-hmm.
Or Medina, how is that?
Yes, that really was exile. In Islam, it's called the Hijra, which is usually translated as emigration. It was not mere emigration. He was exiled from Mecca. He was forced out of Mecca. What happened was that after that first revelation, first of all, there was silence for 2 years, which is not at all what one would expect if this were sort of, you know, some kind of made-up story. And then it kind of almost a dark night of the soul for him. And then more revelations began to come, sort of building up, and at first very, very mystical, and then becoming outspoken protests against the corruption that was happening inside Mecca, which of course earned him the absolute enmity of the Meccan elite, who, and it finally got, you know, he and his small band of early followers were under constant harassment and assault, both verbal and physical. And during that time, and this is 12 years, he took a stand of a downright Gandhian stand, like Gandhi, of passive, nonviolent resistance. Right? He absolutely refused to be provoked into violence. But the violence against him ramped up to the point that there was a concerted attempt on his life, which forced him out of Mecca, 200 miles north to Medina, where, as you say, he founded this extraordinarily idealistic new community along new lines of social justice and basically communal lines, communitarian lines, in which, you know, it didn't matter, wealth didn't matter, you know, whether you were rich or poor, whether you were male or female, your social status and so on, everybody was equal. But also at that time, you know, by then he was becoming not just a spiritual leader but also a political leader. Because that was the basis of this new community in Medina. More and more Medinans became part of the community. And basically he was forced into the role then of political as well as spiritual leader. And part of the being a political leader involves, of course, defense pacts, involved at the time, defense pacts, and the willingness to bear arms. So you then get this for 8 years, this extraordinarily ambivalent attitude towards violent resistance. There were three battles with Mecca fought during that time. And it's clear that in the Quran itself, as his followers are asking him, well, you know, how can we fight? How can we fight in Mecca, which is a holy city? How can we fight near the sanctuary and so on? That even though the Quran gives them permission to fight, it's always hedged about with conditions. Yes, but you know, only if they attack you first, and only if they won't allow you near the shrine, and only this, and only that, and even then, God is merciful, forgiveness is divine, and so on. So basically, better if you don't. And I think this is, to me, quite fascinating. I know that one of the standard stereotypes about Muhammad is that of the sort of, you know, sword-wielding mad warrior. I don't see that at all. I see a man who, yes, took up arms, but did so, as I say, with great ambivalence, and I think was extraordinarily relieved in the end when Mecca surrendered to Medina, and he was, then you get this immense scene of, you know, this man who grew up the marginalized outsider, he then comes back acclaimed as the ultimate insider, but in the surrender, there were, I think, it was either 8 or 12, I've forgotten which one now, 8 or 12 fatalities, and that was all.
Mm.
Yeah. Let's take a call or two. This is Chloe. She's in Miami Beach. Hi.
Yes. Yes. Good morning. Yes, I was going to start out with perhaps a suggestion, an encouragement to write another book. I could see you would be really good at perhaps doing a comparison of the personality or the psychology of these founders, these visionary characters who are reformers, mm-hmm. and you know, Joseph Smith, maybe the person who started the Baha'i religion, there might be some interesting similarities, and then we see that the religions develop into political entities and businesses in a way, and it's, I just wonder, you know, that might be another subject for an agnostic to have an entertaining comparison. Yeah. My question had to do with a program I saw on French television. They interviewed a number of historians, and the sequence of the marriages appeared to be that he had, with Haditha, then was extremely attracted to the second wife, I think it was Aisha, and went to pray, and the angel Gabriel told him, assured him that it would be proper for him to now love Aisha, who is a much younger woman. And so it sounded like it was not sequential, but that Aisha...
There's a lot of, a lot of confusion here about the wives, right? After Khadija died, his followers were extremely concerned because he was, you know, deep, deep in mourning, and they arranged two marriages for him simultaneously. One was to Aisha, who was the daughter of one of his closest companions, Abu Bakr, who became the first caliph, the successor, the Sunni caliph, that is. And she at the time, though, Aisha was young, yes, but she was not a child. She was 9 years old when she was betrothed to him and 12 years old when the marriage was actually consummated, which was the standard age for marriage at the time, with puberty. It was not a love match, though. He was, you know, clearly it was more like father and daughter. She entertained him, she teased him, she delighted him, but it was, you know, this was, in fact, he actually told her at one stage, she was, part of her teasing was, and you can hear, you know, you can hear the voice in here. She, because she's telling the story much later when she's a much older woman. Of course, she outlived him by many, many years. And she said there was one time when she was teasing him and he was missing Khadija and mourning for Khadija. And she said, how can you possibly sort of, something I'm paraphrasing here, how can you possibly sort of long for that toothless old hag when you have here this gorgeous young thing, right? And you think, oh my God. You know, well, yeah, only a teenager could possibly say something like this, right? This total disrespect for anybody older than her. And he just turned around and said to her, on the contrary, he said, Khadija gave me four beautiful daughters and I will never have children with any of my other wives. And he never did.
You know, our time is getting very close to the end of the program. So before we go, I certainly want to mention this. Your book points out that Muhammad rejected the tradition that daughters were less valuable than sons and the marginalization of women. Yet we look at the way women are treated in a lot of Islamic cultures. How can this be?
Isn't it amazing how, you know, sort of these three great monotheistic faiths started off with such high ideals. And then as soon as the founders, you know, disappear physically from the stage, well, I tell you, these old men with long beards turn up and take possession, institutionalize it. And we have this extraordinary ability to mess things up, to begin to take what was inspiring and make it into dogma. It's one of our great human failings.
It seems in addition to wanting to dispel myths about Muhammad, you wanted to dispel myths about the Quran and Islam more broadly. Would you say that?
I'm not really in the myth dispelling business. I'm in the business of trying to understand, trying to broaden our understanding, which of course involves dispelling certain myths. I think, you know, there are so many myths. You know, for instance, you know, the myths about Islam. Okay, we know, you know, the bigotry about Islam that exists nowadays is outstanding, but you know, we are so unwilling to look at the myths about our own faiths. You know, the Jews who are listening, and the Christians who are listening. We also treasure many myths, treasure many stories, treasure many miracle stories, and so on. Even though something in us knows that, okay, maybe it wasn't quite that way. But we are fascinated when we come across a book like, for instance, Dominic Croissant's biography of Jesus, which portrays him as a revolutionary and so on. We can recognize the truth of that. It feels right that, okay, this is the reality. It's not the image we have in mind, but it is an inspiring reality and an exciting reality. My basic approach is that no matter how fabulous or fabled Muhammad's life may be, his life in reality as he lived it is even more remarkable.
Well, on that note, we need to end. I certainly want to thank you, journalist Leslie Hazelton. She's the author of The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. Thank you very much, Leslie Hazelton.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you.
Thank you,
Bonnie.
Thank you so much. Wish we had longer.
Yeah.
And that wraps up today's program. It was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have live streaming, free audio archives, and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program examines what's often termed ecological anxiety. Is man-made always inferior to nature-made? Is there a middle ground between extreme environmentalism and corporate exploitation? Now to the calendar. On this day in 1990, 23 years ago, a stunning boxing upset. Heavyweight champ Mike Tyson is knocked out in the 10th round in Tokyo by Buster Douglas, who had been a 42-1 underdog. And on this day in 1993, 20 years ago, President Clinton announces his choice of Miami prosecutor Janet Reno to be the nation's first and still only female attorney general. Her father, Henry Reno, was a longtime Miami Herald police reporter. One more while we go back to the famous Troopergate business. On this date in 1994, 19 years ago, former Arkansas state clerical worker Paula Jones accuses then-Governor Bill Clinton of making improper sexual advances to her in a Little Rock hotel room. The president denied it. Our theme music, composed by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from Bill Clinton, who of course survived impeachment. Quote, being president is like running a cemetery. You've got a lot of people under you, and nobody's listening. This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.